We have to go into revolutionary organization. We have to support efforts like the National People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. That is essentially an organization that's fighting to try to push back the state to give us the democratic space that we need to pursue the revolutionary interests and aspirations of the masses of African people here and around the world. Thank you very much. Uhuru.
Africa Live. Saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. What we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live.
Raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumah's, and today we have Omali Eshetela.
Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live.
Uhuru and welcome to Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. We're going to be talking today about Barack Obama's cabinet, and we have in the studio Chairman Omali Eshetela, Chairman of the African Socialist International, and we have on the line from California Chairwoman Penny Hess of the African People's Solidarity Committee. I want those of you out there who are listening to feel free to participate in the discussion that we're having. It's best to do so before we're right about the end, so you can get your question heard and we can have a little time to answer it. You can do so by calling in to one of the various numbers. The U.S. number is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call the UK number, which is 020 813-663-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype from anywhere in the African world for free. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. So, to kick this thing off, we want to talk a bit about Obama's foreign policy crew. It has been suggested that Obama has been building a war cabinet, not too much unlike the war cabinet that was built by George Bush. Penny, can you say a little something about that?
Uhuru Chairman, Uhuru Nubinga, and it's a great honor to be on the show again. And just to start out by saying that different media sources have noted that Obama's cabinet choices prove that he's changed the slogan from change to continuity. And as one writer, John Tilger, pointed out, quote, Obama's fans include the war criminals Tony Blair, who has hailed Obama's appointments, and Henry Kissinger, who described the appointment of Hillary Clinton as outstanding. And one of John McCain's principal advisors, Max Boot, who is on the Republican Party's far right, said, I am gobsmacked, whatever that means, by these appointments. They could just as easily have come from a President McCain. So I think that that tells a lot about it. But, to start with, just to talk about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and to review the fact that Clinton was an ardent defender of her husband's economic and military war against Iraq throughout the 1990s. You know, she supported the embargo that the Clinton administration had that killed more people, and especially children, than even Desert Storm did under Bush Sr. Clinton supported the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998, which ultimately laid the path for President George W. Bush's invasion. And as a U.S. senator, Clinton not only voted to authorize the war, but aided Bush's administration's propaganda campaign in the lead-up to the invasion, because this is a quote from her. She said, Saddam Hussein has worked to rebuild his chemical and biological weapon stock, his missile delivery capability, and his nuclear program. Clinton said, when rising to support the measure in October 2002, he has also given aid, comfort, and sanctuary to terrorists, quote unquote, including Al-Qaeda members. And she said, I want to ensure that Saddam Hussein makes no mistake about our national unity and for our support for the president's effort to wage America's war against the terrorists and weapons of mass destruction. And she stated that, quote, I want the Iranians to know that if I am the president, I will attack Iran. And she said, in the next 10 years, during which they might foolishly consider launching an attack on Israel, we would be able to totally obliterate Iran. Clinton has not shied away from supporting offensive foreign policy tactics in the past, and she supported her husband's decision to attack Yugoslavia in 1999. She said, quote, I urged him to bomb. You cannot let this go on at the end of a century that has seen the major Holocaust of our time. What do we have NATO for if not to defend our way of life? And, also the choice of Robert Gates as Secretary of War. Bush's, we've talked about him a little bit in the past, I think, but Gates wants no date set for an Iraq withdrawal, and he's quoted as saying that he wants, quote, well north of 20,000 troops to be sent to Afghanistan. He also wants the U.S. to build a completely new nuclear arsenal, including tactical nuclear weapons that blur the distinction with conventional weapons. So, you know, it's really clear that it is a war cabinet. Madeleine Albright, who's also a war criminal, is very, you know, a powerful advisor in the Obama team. And whether or not she's awarded an official role in the administration, she's going to be a major force in shaping Obama's foreign policy. One of her famous quotes was when she was interviewed on 60 Minutes during the sanctions under the Clinton administration, the sanctions against the Iraqi people, and you know she was confronted by one of the interviewers on 60 Minutes saying that the sanctions were responsible for the deaths of 500,000 children, more than died in Hiroshima. And Albright responded, quote, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." So, you know, this is who we're talking about. Also, just to remind people that Robert Gates is a longtime CIA. He's been in the CIA, and he was also the director of the CIA. Excuse me. was involved in the Iran-Contra affair. He was Brzezinski's underling when Brzezinski was the National Security Advisor under Carter. And Gates is the person who facilitated Brzezinski's plan of building the Mujahideen as a sort of Contra force, a counterinsurgency force to overthrow the progressive government of Afghanistan, which was the most progressive government in the Middle East in the late 70s, and to also draw the Soviet Union into that fight and force them basically to, you know, get involved in a losing battle and destabilize the Soviet Union and ultimately to overturn it. That was Brzezinski's stated goal, which he did admit in interviews with the French press later. And, of course, we saw that the Soviet Union did collapse, 10 years after that. So, let me see, what else about Gates? Gates advocated the bombing of the Sandinista government of Nicaragua and did everything short of an invasion to bring down Nicaragua. And, you know, that's a little bit about who he is. And, of course, Brzezinski is still the chief foreign advisor on the Obama team. And he's been on interviews and stuff stating, what their policies are going to be. And Brzezinski is somebody who he hates the neocons. Mm-hmm. He wants to get out of Iraq, but into a containment of Afghanistan, Russia, China. And, whether he advocates doing that by, quote, diplomacy, which means threats and economic, you know, pressure and that kind of thing, or whether it's straight up attacks and war, or covert operations, which we will probably see more under the Obama regime, possibly. Brzezinski does advocate the use of covert and proxy forces, more sham diplomacy being done with economic intimidation. And, you know, it's just clear that Brzezinski is another sector of the bourgeoisie, of this parasitic system of capitalism. But as his writing shows, he understands the question of national liberation in some ways more than other pundits who call it a religious, you know, religious wars or that kind of thing.
Yeah. Now,
okay, go ahead.
You talking about some of what Brzezinski has said in interviews recently, and I have a clip from a recent interview that Brzezinski did on CNN, where he's talking about Obama's foreign policy or what Obama's foreign policy should be. I'd like to play that quickly so we can discuss that a bit. This is Brzezinski on CNN.
Dr. Brzezinski, what, in a sentence, what would you suggest the guiding foreign policy philosophy for the new administration should be?
Well, in general, what I would say is that it has to originate with Obama and it has to be identified with him, because he is right now the hope, the universal hope. I mean, the enthusiasm for him worldwide is enormous. And they expect from him a rather different American foreign policy from the one that we have had in recent years. And there could be some worry, perhaps exaggerated worry abroad, that he may be outsourcing diplomacy to the Department of State with a very able new Secretary of State, who, however, has disagreed with him on some fundamental foreign policy issues. And he may be outsourcing defense policy to a very able, very good, whom I know very well, Secretary of Defense, who, however, may have somewhat different views, whether on missile defense or on new nuclear weapons or on the pace of withdrawals. So the president has to demonstrate that there is no outsourcing, that he is in charge. And I think the best way for him to do that is in the near future, after he's got his economic team in place, after he has kind of created some degree of domestic confidence, that he addresses the world in very broad terms, perhaps through a very major interview in print, in which he would outline his basic philosophy and the general thrust of what he plans to do after he assumes office. And that would mean, one, how to deal with Europe, two, how to enlarge the global circle of decision makers, three, how to engage the new major powers, notably China, perhaps Russia, but is accommodating. And last but not least, how does he pacify that huge region east of Egypt, west of India, in which we're becoming increasingly bogged down?
And that is Brzezinski on what Obama's foreign policy should be. And he states in it that, you know, Obama's going to have to show that he's not outsourcing anything. And some would suggest that that's funny, seeing as how Brzezinski, his main advisor, is seen by many as the puppet master behind the Obama situation. Yeah. Chairman, what's your view on this?
Well, a couple of things. One thing I think we have to make clear is that this discussion is not just an empty academic abstract review of Obama and his cabinet for purposes of just trying to show that he's a bad guy. The reality is that Obama is significant for us precisely because of what Brzezinski mentioned in terms of peoples all around the world and certainly in this country expecting something different from what they have traditionally known comes from U.S. Imperialism, from imperialism in general. And so this is one reason we're going through this whole discussion. And part of it is to expose the fact that Obama is not different, that in fact he is imperialism with a new face. I think that's extremely important for us to remember, because I'm not interested in just some kind of empty discussion about Obama being a bad guy. The U.S. imperialism is not capable of serving the interests of the peoples of the world and of African people here in this country. It is incapable of doing so. It doesn't matter if the president, nominal leader of the government is African or some other nationality. So that's the starting point. And I think that it would be something relatively easy to understand by people who profess to look for fundamental change, transformation relationships that we have with imperialism, if in fact we aren't talking about many people who really aspire in some way or another to integrate themselves
to assimilate themselves or the particular group that they are associated with into the this American thing. And this American thing is rotten. It was born rotten, and the rot that is America is revealing itself increasingly for everybody to see, which makes an Obama someone who is necessary. But what was really interesting in my view, well, a lot of things, but one thing that was interesting is that Brzezinski talks about people around the world assuming, some people assuming that a possibility that Obama is outsourcing. And then he's, you know, to Clinton and then to Gates, he gives, you know, foreign policy, military direction, leadership, strategic direction to these other forces. And I thought that was really interesting. And to me, it was funny because what Brzezinski was doing is making his own criticism. Brzezinski is saying, we can't do it that way. We can't allow, he's very capable. You know, how is it? I come here not to to what? To something Caesar, but to praise him, but to, you know, and so he talks about the ones, you know, these are noble people, all of them who have their criticism. And he says that, you know, that Clinton and Gates are very fine persons, but we got to make sure that the people understand that we are dismissing and moving away from that kind of politic toward another kind of politic, away from the politic, the obvious politic that Comrade Penny mentioned when she was going through the history of Clinton and going through the history of Gates. He is saying that that stuff is passé and we have to move differently. And part of what he suggests in his statement is that the need to engage other forces in the world differently. And I don't think this is a sham diplomacy that he's talking about. I think from what I've seen and read of Brzezinski in the late period, Brzezinski is one of a number of people who consider themselves realists and who have begun, who actually recognize that the U.S. imperialism has realized certain kinds of limitations, that it cannot function in the same way anymore, and that it will never be a power that can move unilaterally throughout the world again, and that what it has to do is acknowledge that there are new players on the scene that have to be dealt with, and they can't be dealt with in the fashion that the Bush regime, the latest imperialist entity, attempted ahead and attempted to do that. And he mentions China, of course. He mentions Russia. And I think he suggests India in this as well. But there are other forces. And this is not just idle discussion, idle speculation, because even if you look at the thing of the group of 20 now that had the recent economic get-together that they said the outcome couldn't be what it needed to be because Obama was not there. The group of 20 is grown from what was first the group of 7, and then there's a group of 8 when they had to include Russia, and now they happen to include all these other forces around the world who are becoming important. Some of them, you know, like Brazil, South Africa, as they India, China, these other forces who are forging their own space and fighting in their own interests and actually, to some extent, contending successfully with imperialism. And the what has to happen is that U.S. imperialism has to determine whether or not, or had to determine whether or not, it was going to try and carry out the same old policy of simply dominating everybody, dominating the world, or open up the gates to allow others to participate in determining the future of the world. And so that is part of what Brzezinski talks about, having to reach accommodation and come to better relationships with these forces, and then come to some kind of agreement, he says, if you listen to that clip, about how they're going to handle that part of the world. What did he say? East of Egypt and and where was it?
And
west of India, was it? No.
Yeah, or China or something.
Yeah. The thing is, what he's talking about is that area of the world that is where we're talking about Pakistan, Afghanistan, and, you know, et cetera. And, of course, he won't have much struggle with what has been previously articulated by the Obama regime. That's where Obama has talked about going, but Brzezinski wants to make sure that that Obama comes all the way over and does not carry on vestiges of the failed, what he would characterize as failed policies of the past. And I didn't know that Max Boot was actually somebody who was an advisor of Obama, because Max Boot...
McCain. McCain.
Oh, he's McCain. But he, Max Boot was not someone you were suggesting was close to Obama, was he?
No,
I was just saying that McCain's advisor, Max Boot, even loved and praised Obama's choices.
Well, that's a hell of a statement, because Boot is an unapologetic supporter of imperialism. In fact, he likes the notion of, or he did, I don't know what he feels about it now. This was a time where the neocons, as they were characterized, were really riding high, and they were actually openly talking about being imperialist and glorifying imperialism. And Boot was one of those persons, one of the ardent champions of a characterization of the United States as an imperialist power, and talked about, you know, the goodness of imperialism, et cetera. So for him to be someone who would praise Obama's team is a further statement that Obama is simply just a new face of the worst, filthiest imperialist power that has ever existed on the planet Earth, and that's what I think is important about that. And I've sort of talked a long time, but I think it's really important for us to really understand that. When we talk having this discussion, the purpose is not to say, Obama is a bad person, but it is to say that all of those people who have illusions, and there are millions of them around the world and in this country, and particularly in the African community, all of those people who have illusions should be able to recognize that we are talking about imperialism. We're not talking about a policy. What about Hillary Clinton? You know, you're talking about Clinton, you know, who wants to bomb and murder, and then this nonsense that we hear about, you know, how women in power automatically means that, you know, there's going to be less war, and women automatically have a better way of doing stuff. But a woman imperialist is a woman imperialist, and a pig feminist, bourgeois pig feminist is a bourgeois pig feminist. And that's what Clinton is, you know, and that's what they've got here. And you know, people who are chomping at the bits, you know, want to be on the police force so that they can join in killing black people, wants to be the warden, wants to be, in the army so they can fry jets and bomb people around the world. They're joining the same imperialist system. So whether it's Clinton, whether it's Obama, what we're looking at is imperialism, and we have to really struggle to prevent people from apologizing for imperialism. I saw recently, and I have to mention this because this was a person who I recently came to know and had heard of her before, really liked this sister, out of Alabama. And she was on some discussion show about where they were talking about Obama, and, you know, and she was an Obama supporter, and then she... The question came up to around Clinton, and she and some other Negress, you know, were talking about how, yeah, we got to talk about Clinton because we have to fight sexism, you know, some nonsense like that. Like Hillary Clinton has any interest in the welfare of African women or the oppressed women around the world when she's talking about right now, talking about bombing places, who supported bombing places that kill all kinds of women and children, you know, like around the world. It's nonsense. And we cannot pretend to say that it's anything other than that. And that's what I'm saying, that people who really genuinely believe in real transformation, revolutionary change, etc., have to really take the covers off of this stuff. And we can't peddle what Obama regime is and what a Hillary Clinton, you know, like is, and that they are representative of imperialism. And that's just the way that is.
Uh-huh. We're speaking about the cabinet selections of Barack Obama here on Africa Live with Chairman Amalia Yeshitela and Chairwoman Penny Hess. We're going to take a break here, but when we come back, we're going to be asking you to participate in this discussion, to jump in and make your views known, ask your questions about this Barack Obama cabinet.
In the economic sphere, the well-conceived and well-intentioned privatization program.
President Obasanjo. When I came in 8 years ago, many Nigerians.
Senators, throw shiapula gada. When I see our senators, throwing share just to share money. We go share the billions when they're supposed to take fit the people. We go share the billions when they're supposed to take help the people. I don't hear many things. I don't see many things. I don't hear many things. I don't see many things. We make me think many things. We tell me pass anything. We make me think many things. We tell me pass anything. When you turn television and you listen to the radio. When you turn television and you listen to the radio. You go see the things them do. You go hear the things them say. You go see the things them do. You go hear the things them say. You go see the corruption. You go see the inflation. You go see the suffering. Suffering of the people. Lori shiri ship. Ori shiri shistili. Ori shiri shikili. Ori shiri shooting. Ori shiri movement. Ori shiri government. Ori shiri party. Ori shiri system. Ori shiri shitting. Ori shiri shikili. Ori shiri shooting. Ori shiri government. Make me think many things. What tell ya me pass anything? What make me think many things? I say, what tell ya me pass anything?
Welcome back to Africa Live here on AhuraRadio.com, where we're having a sort of a town hall discussion. We're talking about Barack Obama's cabinet. Want you all out there to participate in the discussion that we're having. You can do so by calling in to one of the various numbers, the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001, or the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Now, during the break, Penny, you raised that you had a question that you would like to raise with the chairman.
Uhuru. Well, just in terms of the context of speaking about Obama's evolving foreign policy and the question of Somalia, which is coming into the news more and more. And I was reading something about how Bush is going to or has declared the so-called pirates of Somalia as terrorists, which really indicates the possibility of U.S. troops or at least some kind of coalition troops going into Somalia again. And even the whole issue of the pirates, which the chairman has discussed on previous shows, but, you know, it's really about African people struggling to control their resources. And a couple of things about that. I mean, you know, the specter of war, you know, an attack, an imperialist colonial attack on East Africa again and the Horn of Africa area, and the speculation also that I've seen that possibly U.S. is going to or is in the process of engaging Russia in that, which is sort of seems to be the kind of plan that Brzezinski is talking about, you know, engaging Russia as an ally against not only African people but against China in Africa and the development of AFRICOM, which is a lot, of course, completely about the U.S. continuing to control the resources or attempting to control the resources of Africa. And so I just wanted to raise that about that whole region and maybe bringing in the struggle for the ASI and, you know, the question of Somalia right now.
Uhuru. I'm glad you raised Somalia in part because one thing we're not hearing the Obama camp talk about at all is the Africa question. And clearly, as far as the imperialists are concerned, that Obama, one of his greatest value is going to be in what they assume he can do to forward the interest of U.S. Imperialism in Africa and with African people in general. I think that when you look at Somalia and the possibility that Bush may make a declaration of some need for military intervention there in order to try to create a situation approximating war, it's worth noting that the first Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, is the one who initiated the war in Somalia that has contributed and may be the primary factor that is responsible for the immediate state of Somalia. It was the lame duck Bush, just as this guy is a lame duck, that in the name of some kind of humanitarian mission, this is where they were really beginning to develop the concept of war for humanity, war to serve some kind of humanitarian interest. Somalia, U.S. imperialists, U.S. forces attack Somalia. The really interesting thing about that is that as the same factors were, many of the same factors were at play then that's at play now. And energy, oil in particular. Mm-hmm. There were various forces who had purchased under George Herbert Walker Bush. There are various corporations here that had purchased a huge percentage of the land in Somalia under the prior president, who I think was Siad Barre, I think had been the president where they had purchased this oil. They said they had discovered a valley of oil under Somalia that stretched from Somalia all the way over to Yemen. And so they wanted to come in and get that oil, but there was a raging struggle against the existing regime. And at the point where it looked like one of those forces was about to come to power, then U.S. military, U.S. Discovered this reason for humanitarian intervention. And it's really interesting because at this time, one of the most telling things about the real intent was the fact that the U.S. embassy was located in the Conoco Oil Corporation headquarters. That's where the U.S. embassy was at that time. So Bush initiated it and then left it for Clinton. I think this might have been December of 92, where the humanitarian thing, so-called intervention, occurred. And, of course, Clinton was coming in January, had been elected in November. Bush initiated the war in December. And then Clinton, who had, during the campaign and his election effort, had to overcome a draft-dodging reputation and prove himself willing to employ a U.S. military force to carry out the interests of the corporations, did so, tried to follow through with the Somalia intervention. So that's, you know, like some of the background. And the fact is that because of this kind of intervention and ongoing intervention, Somalia has never been able to consolidate a stable state. In fact, at the point where several months ago it looked like one force was going to succeed in assuming control of Mogadishu, the capital there, the U.S. proxy, Ethiopia, was used to intervene, and the people who were coming to power were characterized as Al-Qaeda linked, you know, Muslim fundamentalists, which was an absolute lie, just a total blatant absolute lie, which, you know, reveals the nature of U.S. politic, that when we look at something that's happening with the governor of Illinois, Blagojevich, that it's not different on the international level either when the U.S. is involved. It was a total lie. And so they used this lie, and so to justify having the Ethiopian proxy to come in, a bomb, and of course, U.S. forces were also involved in this intervention as well, to keep the Islamic forces from coming to power. But now Ethiopia, of course, has been getting beat up pretty badly and is trying to get out of Somalia. And then there is this issue that they talk about in terms of the pirates. And the whole struggle, and at one juncture, it was a contest with the Soviet Union for influence in that region. At one juncture, the Soviet Union was close to the Somali government. The Somali government, which had its own struggles with Ethiopia at that time, which, that was clearly in the arms of U.S. imperialism under Haile Selassie. The U.S. was concerned about protection of the Horn of Africa, because so much of the oil, the energy of the so-called Western countries in the U.S. comes around that Horn of Africa after it's stolen from the Middle East, after it's stolen from that area of the world. They have to, the ships are usually, many of the ships are too large to go through the Suez Canal to get to Europe. So they have to transfer, they have to come around the Horn of Africa in order to bring that oil out. And so there's always been a concern. And so there's been a great struggle that's been going on for a long period of time. And at the point where Haile Selassie lost power, then the U.S. initiated a relationship. Then the Soviets initiated a relationship with the Ethiopian government that came into power, and the Somali government at that juncture then switched over and went to the U.S. because of its, you know, struggle with the Ethiopia. And so that's always been an area of concern, and it still is an area of concern. It doesn't matter who's affecting their ability for resources to transfer that horn to come around that area. It is a matter of fundamentally, profoundly significant concern. I think the last tanker that was stopped by so-called Somali pirates had something like $100 million, was it dollars worth of mm-hmm. oil or something yeah. to that effect on it. So, I mean, this the oil. So if you fighting communism, as they put it, or fighting pirates, the thing is, get them Negroes oil, get the oil, stop anybody from intervening. But they've disrupted the economy of Somalia to such an extent. They've disrupted the lives of the people of Somalia to such an extent, so that there has been an enterprise that has developed around getting the resources that they are stealing. Somebody else has become involved. It's like when the white folks was engaged in piracy, stealing black people and moving us from, you know, place to place. You know, they were called pirates because they intervened in the rackets that was going down between the nobility, the corporations that had all the rights to do that, so they intervened. And now you have people who are now called pirates because they are intervening in this racket that's going down, where the major corporations, major countries are removing all of these resources, leaving the people starving, and so these little domestic enterprises have emerged, which is not to say that the enterprises are good for the people of Somalia, but to say it is to say they are no worse than the other forces who are stealing stuff. At least some of the stuff gets to remain in the area, where nothing remains when it's stolen by you know, the imperialists.
Just to thank you for that, just to add, or just to, you know, raise, in some interview that I saw, the so-called pirates, which they say, by the way, yesterday, that they killed 35, somebody killed 35 of them, but were saying, you know, exactly that the resources had been stolen, and that they were saying that what the resources that they were trying to raise from that ship was going to the people. so I don't know. But
yeah. And the thing is about Russia in this area, you know, I think that if Brzezinski, you know, Brzezinski is somebody who I think they characterize two camps of imperialist thinking representatives right now. That's how they characterize. And these are broad and general camps. One are the ideologues. These are like the neocons and what have you that's going to reshape the world in a certain way. And the others are characterized as realists. These are people like Brzezinski, Zarid, Farid, Zakaria, you know, and others. You know, I guess Albright might be put in this same camp as well, who are prepared to see the fact that the U.S. doesn't have the same power, the same influence in the world. And so they're going to have to reach out to new kinds of relationships with these different forces, some of whom have been previously seen as absolute adversaries, and to reach new arrangements. It's like, you know, like mafia forces who trying to see how they can get along and still share dwindling resources without killing each other. And so I think that kind of thing is happening. Now, a problem is that Brzezinski and others have really been concerned about the brazen aggression that the U.S. has been made against Russia, especially on its border, where, you know, the thing that happened with Georgia, where this reactionary, bloodthirsty Georgian government actually felt like they had got a nod and a wink from the U.S. and attacked these two states, these two Georgian enclaves that had succeeded, had not, actually not been brought into the embrace of the Georgian government with the split of the Soviet, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Soviet troops, as characterized as peace troopers, were in there. Akazia, I think, is one, and and the other. And so, you know, this attack there was seen by many people as a U.S.-involved, U.S.-inspired effort to actually take all of that. And then they're talking about bringing Georgia into the into NATO and other interests, taking NATO and U.S. military and Western, quote-unquote, Western imperialist military right up to Russia's doorstep, really brazing, threatening, aggression, aggressive. And so Brzezinski is one who would argue that the interests of the U.S. Would be better served if they could reach some kind of better relationship with Russia because, for example, they're talking about this this natural gas pipeline that they want to run, I think, through Georgia or something like that, that's supposed to be, you know, bring, you know, be helpful to the energy requirements of the U.S. and European corporations.
I think it's already in.
Well, I think at one juncture, on more than one occasion, I think the Soviets have been able to disrupt that. And I think that they want a better relationship, so I can see them trying to work out something that the Soviets would agree and work with them in that area, the Russians would, rather, and they would work with the Russians to, you know, ease that situation that exists in places like Georgia, you know, et cetera. I can see them saying that, you know, trying to come to some kind of accommodation, because they really do need. This is not just you know, some theoretical, you know, discourse that they're involved in. They got to solve some real practical problems. And the problems are that there are growing, their forces with a greater capacity now than they ever had before in terms of dealing with the U.S. U.S. is in a relatively weaker place. I mean, this person I mentioned earlier, Farid Zakaria, who I think is foreign editor for Newsweek magazine, one of the bright stars of the day, has recently written a book talking about the post-American world. And this is, they're talking about, there's a whole new situation out there. There are new players here. There are forces who are not going to play the game the way the U.S. wants to play it anymore. And how do we bring them into the broad imperialist camp that can keep a smaller but most essential oppressed world in its place. When I say smaller, what I mean by that is that people who there's certain kinds of resources that are no longer available, and that means that it's necessary for that they become much more significant now than they were before. Africa is such a place as that. But now, you know, they're talking about Brazil can't be in the same equation. India can't be in the same equation. South Africa can't be in the same equation. China is no longer part of that equation. You know, so many forces, you know, are not playing the game that way. And they would like to bring as many of those as possible who are essential onto the same team. And that collectively, then they would try to preserve for as long as possible a system that requires the blood-sucking of the rest of humanity. And, of course, that is especially true of Africa.
Yes. Just to say to that, I mean, it just seems like Africa as an entity of its own is the one thing that's not in this equation. Africa is, like you say, Chairman, the object of history in this whole scheme of things of the Obama administration and imperialism.
And that's why the thing that we want to work, I mean, we're working tirelessly with, is building a revolutionary response from Africa and African people. And this is what's really important to understand, because that's why people, especially who consider themselves revolutionaries and progressives and what have you, Africans in this country, get sucked up into this Obama phenomenon, where they would surrender an historical mission that has been imposed on us by history, as suggested. And because the reality is that Africans who are in this country, you look at the stats about our conditions of existence, and people in prison, the health care, the joblessness, the police murders, the homelessness, all of this. And what you have to come to understand is that what has happened to us is that we brought with us from Africa the colonial conditions of Africa itself, have simply been extended from Africa to the U.S., to Jamaica, to all these other places. And we suffer as a consequence of what has happened to Africa. And our future is to fight to regain Africa and to regain our relationship with each other, and to surrender Africa and to surrender our relationship with each other to the promise, to some essentially fraudulent promise that somehow we could be allowed to participate in the blood sucking. We can be allowed to integrate into this thing is just the worst possible kind of scenario that I can think of. And again, the question is, for African people, whether the objective is to become a part of this cancerous, to become a part of this parasitic entity, or to win freedom from it, or to win liberation from it, win a capacity to run our own lives as a people, and to guarantee that our children are going to have a future. And we got to remember, we're living in a U.S. that hates African people, a U.S. that does not support African people here or any place on earth in general, but a U.S. that supports and loves Barack Obama. That should say something about what we are dealing with here.
Yeah. We're going to take a break here on Africa Live on WhoRadio.com. When we come back, we're going to deal with some of the questions that you have out there. So stay tuned here on WhoRadio.com.
Yeah. Israeli too. E-Africa. Got to do this, man.
Oh, Major.
Yeah. Yo, I gotta go, baby. Revolution in the air, baby. Yeah. To all my revolutionary people out there, brothers and sisters, this young Ace. Yo, let me rock it like this. Yeah. Like the Panthers did in 67. I'm about to run up in Capitol Hill with brandished weapons. Put the peace to the crackers facing. Then ask politely, can we talk about reparation? Now some may say that's rash, but my people getting played like a jackass. And when I think about it, I ain't the criminal, see you stole me. So the way I see it, you owe me 42
back since the Birmingham bombing, and I'm still turning pages to see black churches still burning. So excuse me if I ain't interested in rituals. Time to get political, yeah. You want me out the country, fine. I leave as soon as you get the hell out of mine. I best believe. Yeah, here I stand. Yo, John Doe about to make Americans scared like I'm the president of Iran. It's Revolution. Yeah, the land is ours. If they touch one, then they touch all. Yeah, I know the truth is scary, but what you expect? I'm a revolutionary. Man, I don't want the people calm. Time to create 2-3 many Vietnams. Think I'm joking, yo, I'm serious. We gotta bring down the imperialists. The socialists is coming through. And if you on the wrong side, we coming right through you. Revolution coming soon through your way. By the way, rest in peace, Kwame Ture. There's no time to play, yo. I think somebody better tell him about the great work done by O'Malley. I should tell a courageous fella, bringing back the soul of the body and leader of the African Socialist Party. The first brother that I heard say this phrase, all my revolutionary people help me say, come on. Is, where, lead, do, e, Africa. Yeah, the land is ours. You touch one, then you touch all. Come on. Is, where, lead, do, e, Africa. Yeah, the land is ours. If you touch one, then you touch all. Yo, the reason why we say that is to remember who we was from way back. Africa, the land is ours. We're gonna take it back from the European powers. And I'm here to let you know, all your Uncle Tom and Aunt Jemima's gotta go. Yeah, you sold us for a black capitalism right next to slavery. That's the biggest capital prison. Once you take it for the system that enslaved you, you gotta do whatever the hell like they say do. Yeah, you black, but now you speak for whites. You want an example? Look at Condoleezza Rice. You wanna see the best of we? Then learn your history so you can change your destiny, yeah. Yo, E-Africa, you say it's we led through. Now I'm out like the Mau Mau, Uhudu, yeah. Yo.
Welcome back to Africa Live here on thehoororadio.com. We're here with Chairman O'Malley Eshetela, Chairman of the African Socialist International, in the studio. And on the line we have with us Penny Hester, Chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. I'm your facilitator, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we want you all to participate in this discussion that we're having. You can call in to one of our numbers. Our U.S. number is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call our UK number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Begin with one of the questions that we have, which is from Onazine, who asks, thank you, says, Uhuru, thank you for your analysis on the Obama question. We understand that neocolonialism is the last strategy for imperialism. When this fails, what will be left for them to do?
Well, they can come up with their hands up and assume the position, as it's put. No, I think that's a really important thing, because Kwame Nkrumah, the incredible leader of African people, who was the first elected president of Ghana, you know, accurately determined, declared that neocolonialism is the last stage of imperialism, a final stage of imperialism, and that you know, it doesn't have anything to hide behind once it doesn't have neocolonialism. And that's one of the things that makes the Obama presidency so significant, because it is like neocolonialism on steroids. You know, we've been looking at neocolonialism throughout the African world, and this guy brings it all home to us. And the exposure of neocolonialism here, I believe, gives us the final move toward revolutionary transformation of our condition as a people around the world. So I think that what this provides us with just an excellent opportunity now to build for genuine revolutionary transformation, to build for real change that that the Obama camp attempted to hijack, you know, in their own to further the aims of imperialism.
We have a another question which asks about the Blagojevich.
Blagojevich.
There you go. A lot of people can't pronounce his name, but they can't pronounce criminal.
Crook.
But it asks what the implications are for this scandal for Barack Obama with the implication of Rahm Emanuel and Jesse Jackson Jr. in this scandal.
Where is that from?
That's from Louise.
From Louise. Uhuru Africa. Yeah, that's going to be a really that's a good question. I think it's going to haunt them. I don't think right away it's going to be that significant, because all of the imperialists want Obama to succeed. That's and everybody's doing everything they can to make him successful. So they're trying to cover up as much as they can about his connections. But the reality is that when you look at Blagojevich, you're looking at Chicago in Illinois politics. That you cannot make your way through the political terrain in any serious way in Chicago without being a part of that mess. You know, you got to know something about it, even if you're not immediately and directly involved in it. In terms of Jesse Jackson Jr., he is saying he had nothing to do with it. He's just like Sergeant Schultz from the old Hogan Hero. I know nothing, etc. But the fact is that that Jackson's younger brother actually is employed by, works for, one of the persons who was involved in this discussion with aides and advisors, representatives, I should say, Blagojevich for this seat. And as you know, the thing is that Blagojevich wanted to sell that seat for something. And Jackson is representatives are said to have offered at least $1 million for the seat, so that he would replace this guy for $1 million. And Blagojevich may have determined that that with the kind of money that Obama has raised, that the going rate may be higher than $1 million. But it seems it's really representative of the politic in that area. And this is not just one rep. You know, you're talking about people like the Jared woman who is his personal advisor, who herself was involved in housing scams and what have you, though that's been cleaned up. You're talking about Penny Pritzker, who was his chief financial advisor, not his advisor, but she was his chair of his financial committee, a billionaire, a woman who created the subprime mortgage entity, and there are a whole host of others. Even this guy Rahm Emanuel is tied, and you know, to all kinds of shady deals, etc. So immediately they have a need to try to protect Obama because of their own interests. But I do believe in the long term, perhaps even in the short term, the middle term, we're going to see fallout from this, because they can't hold this thing together. The fact is that imperialism is in crisis, and that as much as they would try to give it a new face in the form of Obama, they're not going to be able to sustain it. I'm convinced of that.
Chairman, I was reading somewhere that Valerie Jarrett was who the Obama faction was trying to get into that seat.
Oh, yeah, I had seen that, too, that she was the person that Obama wanted to take the seat. But listen, this is something that from the New York Times. our guest today. It starts off last Sunday night, President-elect Obama's three closest friends, Martin Nesbitt, Eric Whitaker, and Valerie Jarrett, sat down in the study of Nesbitt's mansion in Chicago for one of their increasingly frequent heart-to-hearts. They were puzzling over a new challenge: how the Obamas, who hoped to remain close to their Chicago friends, would spend time with them while living in the isolation chamber of the White House. Over Diet Cokes, the three drafted the beginnings of an elaborate visiting schedule that will bring Hyatt Park to Washington so the first family can have a taste of home. And we see what a taste of home is like when we talk about Chicago. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is Chicago where dead people vote. You know what I mean? And then I heard...
Where Africans are tortured.
Yeah, yeah. Africans are tortured, mm-hmm. you know, and live in some of the worst starvation in the country, poverty in the country.
In Obama's district.
In his district.
Imposed by some of the people who were in that very article.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So perhaps we can speak now on...
Excuse me. I just think, what's the guy's name who bought Obama's, gave Obama, made it, sold him the house? Resco. I mean, the double dealing that was involved in the Resco deal for Obama to get him the house that, you know, at underpriced and all of this, and who was one of his biggest financiers, et cetera. Obama's is there. He's there in the mix. You don't get to be senator out of Illinois without being in the mix, you know. And so that's all there is to that. So anyway, comrade, go ahead. Uhuru.
Uhuru. So perhaps we can now speak a bit about the another section of Obama's cabinet, the section dealing with economics. Penny, I know you have some information on who he's got and some implications there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, that it's interesting that scandal is rearing its head on many fronts around the Obama administration or upcoming administration. And, you know, the media and the bourgeoisie are warding it off. But the same is true in the economic situation, and even Bloomberg Financial News, which is, you know, New York Mayor Bloomberg's, newspaper and online service, said, quote, by one of its columnists, quote, "So by my tally, almost half the people on Obama's economic advisory board have held financial positions at companies that to one degree or another either fried their financial statements, help send the world into an economic tailspin, or both." So, I mean, it's the same old, criminals and that he's bringing in that doesn't even, within the context of capitalism itself, have the ability to solve any kind of problem, even for capitalism, not to mention, you know, for the benefit of the people in any kind of way. And I think that it's interesting because when we were, you know, in all the years that we were studying about the U.S. government bringing drugs in, imposing drugs on the African community, a lot of times we would find out that information from ex-CIA agents that would be writing stuff or ex-narcotics cops or things like that. Well, even just like on understanding this economic crisis, we have to read disgruntled capitalist Wall Street investors that have to put out the truth, or something close to the truth anyway, have to expose some of this because they want their interests met. And one whole sector of Wall Street, disgruntled Wall Street guys, are angry and struggling with the Obama administration because he is not exposing the Wall Street criminals for who they are, which, you know, another sector wants to happen so that around the world people would reinvest. I mean, what I'm saying is that a few years ago, I think it was Sweden's economy collapsed, and what they did was they took all the bankers, the stock market bankers, and put them on trial and force them to open up their books. And then people, you know, other investors around the world reinvested then because they felt confident to do that. But, you know, this government obviously has covered it over and hasn't done that. And even China is saying that it's not going to reinvest as long as it knows, it doesn't know what's on the books of these corporations. So it's just really interesting that, you know, if he wanted to save capitalism, he would do that. And Obama's not even doing that. And his people are the same. Robert Rubin, who has not been named to anything yet, but is a top advisor of Obama's economic team, and who was the Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton, is also facing scandal right now. And just to say, I don't know if people read about it, but in the last couple of days, there's been this stuff in the New York Times and other media sources about this investor. I think his name is Madoff or something like that, Madoff, who was a top Wall Street investor for 40 years, and there's no reason why, you know, the New York Federal Reserve and the SEC and all these agencies of the U.S. government didn't know this, but he had been running what's called a Ponzi scheme. And a Ponzi scheme is where people, you know, like, I take $100 from the chairman and keep, you know, 75 of it for myself, and then I take $100 from Nibinga and give him 25, you know. Anyway, it's just like taking people's money and moving it around, and there's no investment going on, which even if it were, it would just be, you know, in a parasitic system at the expense of African people. But anyway, it was completely a fraud. And I was just reading that Spain had huge investments in this guy Madoff's investment firm, and they're losing all this money from the country of Spain, and all over the world people were invested in this, and now they've just exposed, and the guy's supposedly under arrest, or he's out on, you know, $5.5 million bail or something. And we're going to see more and more of that. And in fact, in the New York Post on December 4th, I saw this online, but I've not seen it anyplace else, but it's saying that Citigroup, which is Robert Rubin, who's the CEO, one of the CEOs there, it says a new Citigroup scandal is engulfing Robert Rubin and his former disciple, Chuck Prince, for their roles in an alleged Ponzi-style scheme that's now choking the world banking system. It said Director Rubin and ousted CEO Prince and their lieutenants over the past 5 years are named in a federal lawsuit for an alleged complex cover-up of toxic securities that spread across the globe, wiping out trillions of dollars in their destructive paths. Investor plaintiffs in the suit accuse Citi management of overseeing the repackaging of unmarketable collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, which we have talked about before, are just another word, a code word for the subprime mortgages bundled up and repackaged as an investment tool. And nobody wanted these CDOs, and then Citi was reselling them, you know, and then hiding the poisonous exposure off the books in shell entities. And just to say that all of these companies, from the ones that have already gone bankrupt or, you know, fallen, like Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, but Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, they all have these secret off-the-books numbers that they're not exposing. And you know, it's just the government is allowing that to go on, and the bailout of course facilitated that happening. But back to this article from the New York Post, it said the lawsuit said that when the bottom fell out of the shaky assets in the past year, Citi's stock collapsed, wiping out more than $122 billion of stockholder value. However, Robert Rubin and other top insiders were able to keep Citi shares afloat until they could cash out more than $150 million for themselves in suspicious stock sales calculated to maximize the personal benefits from undisclosed inside information, the lawsuit said. the latest troubles for Reuben Prince and others emerge in a 500-page investigation, et cetera, et cetera. And then it says, Reuben cleared $30.6 million on his stock sales, while Prince got $26.5 million. Former COO Robert Druskin got nearly $32 million, and former Global Wealth Management Unit Chief Todd Thompson got $25.7 million, the suit said, et cetera. So this is Robert Reuben. He was, again, the Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton, his first Secretary of the Treasury, and Tim Geithner and Lawrence, who's going to be the Secretary of the Treasury now under Obama, and Lawrence Summers, who is, I forgot what his post is, he's the head of the Economic Council or something like that under Obama. They are both proteges of Reuben, and Reuben is the one that under Clinton lobbied for, fought for the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the 1933 Depression era act that put regulation on Wall Street that prevented the kind of speculation that's been going on in the last period. As soon as that was repealed, Wall Street was wide open to just blatantly exploit and drive into the ground, create starvation for colonial governments and stock markets around the world and inside this country to do whatever they wanted to do at the expense of the African, Mexican, oppressed people. And as soon as that was repealed, then Reuben left his post as Secretary of the Treasury and went to Citigroup and immediately started cashing in and making this $150 million for himself. So, I mean, this is who Obama's team is. Tim Geithner was the head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. He knew everything that was going on in this period. He was there. His policies facilitated the kind of ultra-parasitism that we've been seeing. And, as soon as he was named Secretary of the Treasury under Obama, the stock market went up for the first time in weeks. Lawrence Summers, just a foul, anti-African, white nationalist, just dog, also, who's going to be in there, same policies, same thing, Wall Street insider. And as far as the Secretary of Housing, or HUD, was just named, I think, yesterday, and his name was Sean Donovan. I don't know a lot about him, but I do know that he was the New York City Housing Commissioner under Bloomberg. So that says a lot right there. And, it's just the same old criminals that Obama has been, and it's just a continuation.
I just wanted to say that in terms of the guy with the 40-year Ponzi scheme, mm-hmm. and I forgot how many billions of dollars were involved in that. And
at least 50 billion.
Yeah, and then there's the issue of Reuben and his Ponzi scheme involvement. You know, like what we're looking at is clearly they could not have been doing this for 40 years or 5 years without some nominal oversight entity mm-hmm. being aware of it occurring. But, you know, what seems to be really clear is that we're living at an era of capitalist crisis, imperialist crisis, and that if it works, then these things that they do, if they work, then they're legal.
Mm-hmm.
But if they blow up in the face of the system and contributes to the problem for the system, then they get declared illegal. That the bourgeois state, the capitalist state, legalizes itself. So, you know, like this way, the guy could do this for 40 years, mm-hmm. 40 years, and not just dealing with chumps, but dealing with fundamental entities that are out there in the world, big time entities that's out there in the world, could not do that with 40 years in the dark. So mm-hmm. the thing is that as the crisis happens, as it mucks up the whole flow of capital, as it contributes to and exposes the contradiction itself, then this becomes criminal activity that they go ahead and do something about. And in terms of, you know, like the U.S. being able, that's the whole question about the U.S. being able to jail bankers and things like that. As you mentioned earlier, that's being required by some countries, some international corporations as evidence that the U.S. is fixing this thing. It requires actions like this little thing they did with the 40-year, you know, Ponzi scheme. But the fact is that all of the system was tied up into and is tied up into that process. And even now, they cannot say, you know, they talk about toxic resources. They don't know what's toxic and what's not toxic. Mm-hmm. You've got a situation where last year, I think it was Goldman Sachs in 2007, drew in something like $60-some-odd billion, which was larger than the gross domestic products of 20 different countries. You got, you know, people like Paulson, who is reputed to have $500 million tied into himself, into Goldman Sachs. His brother, another $500 million tied into Goldman Sachs, $1 billion between them. And then they're talking about rescuing the economy when it's clear that rescuing the economy is rescuing themselves and people just like them. And then, you know, even as you look at this this thing that's happening with the auto industry, you know, which is also a scam. But the difference here is really interesting, is that they can't give any resources to the auto industry. They're going to come up with something. But their failure up to now has been blamed on the auto workers, because the auto workers won't make concessions, and they can't see how the auto workers, the unions, are going to make these concessions that's going to, you know, benefit the corporations. Well, they didn't require a single concession and turned over absolute control, non-veto control of the economy to Goldman Sachs, essentially in the form of Paulson. But they can say that the workers are responsible for it because they make too much money. And the contest, the whole question of the workers, and this is something that we won't be able to talk about much right now, but the real all value in the world is created by workers. You know, so they say the workers make too much damn money. How in the hell can the workers be making too much money when the corporations at General Motors are making all that money who don't work? They don't work. They don't make no cars. They don't fix no tires. They don't do any of that. They're not on the assembly line. And they don't do anything. And they get all these billions of dollars. And then the workers, they say, are making too much per hour. And therefore, that what we got to do is break the workers, break the union. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, that's what the attack is on the working class, is to attack the workers and give all the resources to the corporations. So it's all just nonsense, and that's why we have to build a revolution. That's the only thing going to fix this, I couldn't call Barack Obama stupid, because he's not. He's a very clever, you know, articulate, one of the best representatives of imperialism they had in a long time, but it's too late, too little, too late. You should have brought a Negro in earlier, but you didn't believe in it then, and so now you wait this long and bring in a Negro, and he's not going to be able to help you, because we're gonna make this revolution, notwithstanding his little pretty face and left hand jump shot.
Yeah. You know, a question I have is the implications for the ability even for them to continue to do these types of things, like the scam that the guy was running for 40 years. In light of the fact that, like, these other forces, you know, are coming into prominence, to China's and India's and whatnot. And I was reading in Foreign Policy magazine, you know, and I've seen suggestions otherwise, you know, that even, you know, they're going to have to make some concessions. Like, right now, I understand that, like, with the World Bank and the IMF, there's a deal, like, where the heads of those are always an American and a European. But you know, that they're going to have to even make concessions in that area. And I'm wondering what the implications of that are for their ability to continue to even do these types of scams to steal all these resources.
Well, that's really interesting because one of the things, of course, that Comrade Hugo Chavez is doing is working to try to make the IMF and the World Bank irrelevant. You know, I mean, these are, no matter what they say they're about, these have been instruments, terrible, horrible instruments of exploitation, grinding down impoverization of millions and millions of people, hundreds of millions of people around the world, and particularly in Africa. And I think that the kind of thing that Chavez is attempting to do, I think, is going to prove to be significant. I think you know, we may even see some other, you know, liberal, progressive kinds of interventions, you know, coming from places like Iran, et cetera, who, either with, you know, forces like the Chavez initiative or other kinds of things. So it's going to be, I think that what they're doing now is struggling for relevancy. I think that the question for most of the U.S. and imperialist initiatives now, the thing that Brzezinski is talking about, what he's really fighting for, what Farid Zakariyyeh, what they are involved in now is an attempt to maintain any kind of relevancy for U.S. imperialism. I think the same thing is basically true of imperialism at large. That's not to say that, you know, they're going to roll over and die tomorrow. But I think looking at it long term, this is what the real struggle that they're involved in is about, to try to maintain some state of relevancy. Because the world doesn't stand still, and we are going to succeed in Africa and with African people. We're going to make this revolution, and our objective is to disengage. Is to disengage totally from IMF, from all of the imperialist structures, and to look within and look at forces, you know, like those attempting to emerge out of Venezuela and other places, where we can renegotiate what kinds of relationships economically can be developed among the working peoples of the world.
Well, we're going to take a break here on Africa Live on WhoRadio.com, where we're speaking about the Barack Obama cabinet and much more. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we want you to participate in the discussion that we're having. So stay tuned. We're just going to be a moment.
Shout. One time for your mind.
Jackson is
the ghetto is the man.
Check it out.
Both gorillas, the gangsters, projects, the pyramids. The U.S. government is conducting experiments. The terror commenced with slavery like Maryland's, when we was taken from Africa, called Americans. We worked all day and slept in the slave quarters. I used to be the overseer, now the Jake's on us. We still live as slaves, trapped in the same borders. Only difference now, we go to work with 8 quarters on the train, telling ourselves to maintain all the way to misery, coming home to the same bullshit. The pigs walk the block with 4 clips, trying to send us to the place preachers talk about in pulpits. Who you with? Someone set you plain. Don't be from the wrong hood that can get you bang on the rail. That shit got many brothers blasted. It got caught on the wrong side of Mother Gaston. The state gave us track to make the people struggle backwards, to make sure war against the state was unimagined. Part of the war they was making on the masses, to make sure the black population stayed trapped in
the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. A fan take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. A combat got snatched by the jakes. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states.
On the border of Guinea and Sierra Leone, your colonial soldiers is heavily armed to keep the masses of the Africans separate from our resources getting ripped off by these imperialist hogs. It's so hot it truly could pour till we control the fruits of our soil. We in pursuit of our gold, we end up traveling to North America in pursuit of resources that we were severed from. But if you're looking for a better life, forget it done. You came to the terror dome when niggas getting hung. Matter of fact, we would leave if we had consciousness, but the white ruling class control the politics. They're telling us to integrate into the populace and be a good house nigga like Obama is. But the fact is, Africans is held captive from a land we was fractured.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. A fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states.
Chucked in the sticks by the state. My car bag got snatched by the jits. After kids take a day by the day. That's how it is when you trap by the state.
We had war with house niggas and police. Winters with no heat. Junk food and corner stores leave us with no teeth. Don't fuck with no beef. Take worms or take what you earn. Even looking like you don't eat. With all the bullshit going on in my community, it make me wonder what more these crackers could try to do to me. Anything that you could think of, they throw me. From the slum lords to the local fiends, we don't sleep. The shots ring out regularly in the middle of the night. Clap back or don't eat. It's that simple. It's not a riddle. The only issue, who to put these slugs into? Who responsible for the bullshit we go into? We say the state got us trapped in this misery, living in the ghetto. Some say we in prison in the mental. I disagree. We held hostage militarily.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. Our fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My car bag got snatched by the jits. Happy kids take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states.
Yeah. Israeli too. E Africa. Gotta do this, man.
Oh, Major.
Yeah. Yo, I got.
Yo, turn this motherfucking shit up.
Welcome back to Africa Live here on TheHooRadio.com. We're speaking with Omali Eshetela, Chairman of the African Socialist International, and Penny Hess, Chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. And we're talking about Barack Obama's cabinet and so much more. You can participate in the discussion that we're having here by calling in to one of our numbers. The U.S. number is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. Or you can call the UK number, which is 020-8133-6629. And, of course, that country code is 44. You can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world for free. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. I'd like to open it up at this juncture for any questions from anyone in the studio.
Uhuru, Chairman. You were playing the talking earlier about the foreign policy and Brzezinski and the efforts of imperialism right now to expand and make alliances with emerging forces like China and some of the different countries. And I was a couple of things I was wondering about. One is if that's more aligned with, like, the difference between Bush and the difference between Republicans and Democrats. Isn't it often that the Republicans is the more overt bombing, more overt military action, and then with the Democrats often favoring a covert, where the contractors, the private contractors, like with Kennedy, Bay of Pigs, you know, just the whole way of doing it covertly instead, so that it doesn't appear that the U.S. is this military aggressor, was one question. And another one related to that is, if they're talking about expanding, like the Group of Eight, the Group of 20, whatever, expanding these alliances, what does that mean for the people whose resources are being exploited and whose labors are being exploited? Does that mean that the imperialists are willing to take less because they're going to share the colonial booty? Or does that mean that the burden of production exploitation is going to be even larger on the people who are having their resources stolen from them, because now it has to sustain a larger group of parasites?
Uhuru. Well, clearly, that would be the attempt to shift the burden all the time on the masses of the people. And that's one of the things that's made neocolonialism really effective. If you look almost any place in the African world, the actual material conditions of African people are worse under neo-colonialism than they were under direct white colonialism itself, which is not to say that all the conditions are worse, but just in terms of material conditions. South Africa, of course, being the latest glaring example, but you can find that all over the world. While there are a handful of people who are tied, the neo-colonial forces themselves, who are better off, obviously, and sometimes in ridiculously obscene displays of wealth, you know, which is has often been part of their downfall. So, yeah, they would try to shift this to the broad masses of the people. But the weakness is that even as they move in the fashion that they're moving, is the depth of the contradictions that do exist in these countries. I mean, I don't know how many strikes happen in China right now, workers per year, and uprisings and things like that go on a regular basis. Look at what just happened in India, the best laid plans of the imperialists at Mumbai, where you had that, you know, outbreak, and then the contest between India and Pakistan, how they impact on these plans that the imperialists have for trying to calm things, but the contradictions of imperialism themselves continue to you know, wreak havoc, you know, like in this process. So, yeah, they would try to shift it on the mass of the people, but I think that further contributes to the probability of revolutionary solutions being sought by and sometimes being achieved by broad masses of people throughout the world. In terms of I don't think the difference in the Democrats and the Republicans are that stark, because, you know, if you look at what's happening in Iraq now, we probably never have seen as many contractors being used in U.S. history. I mean, this is just a legalized mercenary forces have been developed, and these are Republicans who have done that. And I agree that that the Democrats have, generally speaking, a different kind of reputation. But mostly that's been, you know, like a lot economically. The what we've seen with the Bush regime, we've got to remember, George Herbert Walker Bush was considered a moderate imperialist. And this other guy, the Negro general, was seen as a Colin Powell, as a moderate imperialist. And this was a Republican as well. And even Eisenhower was seen as a moderate imperialist, you know, so who was a Republican. And it was Truman, the Democrat, who presided over the atomic bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the greatest probably single act of terror permitted in human history, if you look at just a specific act of one specific act of terror. So I don't think it's that clear, a Democrat or Republican issue. And I think that it would really serve us to recognize that these are just labels that they attach to themselves, and capital moves back and forth and you know, between them, while at sometimes it is probable that certain economic interests represent themselves in the form of political policy, you know, like it's been said before accurately that politics is concentrated economics. So depending on what kind of interests are at work, you know, you will see that manifested in more warlike situations. The arms industry tied to right now, like seems to be like more Republican. The oil industry tied to, so there's a real need for war and that kind of aggression to keep those industries afloat and moving ahead. But then you have financial capital. That's, you know, historically has been talked about the Eastern capitalists, the Rockefellers and what have you, who've been hated by other sectors of the Republicans, you know, certain sectors of the Republicans themselves. And even here you have a situation where there are camps in the Republicans who hated the George Bush neocon forces, you know, who really detested those forces, and they had serious kinds of disagreements. So there are all these forces constantly jockeying for influence over public policy, over foreign policy, over economic policies and things like that. and attempting to sell themselves and their ideas to whatever imperialist force will, whatever sector of the ruling class will listen to them as being, you know, more advantageous to their interests. And sometimes what we will find is that, and I believe that we are close to such a time right now, is that the entire system itself, that all of the imperialists can find themselves more or less in the same boat, in the sense that the whole thing could sink if they don't come to some kind of common agreement about how to move forward, you know.
Yeah. I was, you know, the other day I was thinking to myself, I was wondering, you know, I wonder if George Bush, the one that's in the office now, would do something like the other Bush had done with Clinton, with the starting the war in Somalia, lame duck. When I thought about it, I was like, hold on, but what would he do? You know, I mean, attack Iran? Obama said he'd attack Iran. You know, attack right. Pakistan? Obama wants to get all up in Pakistan, too. You know, give Palestine to the Israeli state? Well, Obama said that Jerusalem, they can have that, you know. So it's like, you know, you can't even think of something that he might do that Obama wouldn't say, well, I'm down with it. You know? So, yeah, I just found that interesting. You know, that it's clear that that they the same guys.
Yeah, they are.
Same guys.
They are.
Do we have any other questions from the studio?
Can we put out the number again in the event that, because we know what happens usually is that people wait until the show ends and then they shoot in all their emails and saying, why didn't you give us more time so that we could have got the emails in?
Let's do that. You know, if you want to email us, if you want to call us and participate in this discussion, this is how you can do it. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. Or you can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world for free. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Don't wait too long because your time is now. We've got about 13 minutes or so left.
I wanted to make this comment, comrade. It's perhaps something that we don't talk about enough, and we suffer in many ways from just a terribly poorly educated, in terms of political education, mass of people in this country. And perhaps perhaps I've never seen it as bad as I see it now. But the real issue, again, is what is it that you're fighting for? If one really simply aspires to join with this terrible entity now, to join, to become a part of the U.S. empire, to become a part of imperialism, then, you know, I can at least understand why they would become supporters of Obama. But the reality is that America is an imperialist entity. It is a capitalist entity. It is an entity that is based on exploitation. Exploitation that can only occur around the world as a consequence of tremendous oppression of peoples, countries, nations, et cetera, who in many instances are starved to death. I mean that literally. People who spend most of their time trying to just get a meal for the day is what we see in much of Africa. And the reality is that capitalism doesn't work for the broad masses of people. It requires exploitation. It requires being able to steal value from human beings who are the real producers of the world, appropriation of value by people who don't do any work. And that, objectively speaking, the struggle is for communist existence. And by communist, I mean an existence of non-exploitation, where people do benefit from their labor, and the workers who produce everything are the ones who are the at best the authorities in the societies where things are produced. And it is the condition for the existence of a world without borders, where you don't have to have nations exploiting nations and et cetera, where you don't have trade imbalances, et cetera, because the resources of the world belong to the people of the world. And the people who fight for a just society have in the recent past been characterized as some kind of blind idealist. Of course, we mean something else when we talk about idealism, but that who are out of touch with reality. We've been told that it is human nature to be greedy, to want to covet and want to steal what somebody else has or somebody has more, and it's not human nature. We've seen this as a function of certain kinds of relationships that people have to economy, how people earn their livings, how people engage in the distribution of the products of their labors, etc. But it is nothing inbred in humans ourselves. We have artificial goals established for us in terms of economy. It's not good enough to have situations where peoples can have good and clean food and water and decent shelter. We have to have situations where there are four or five mansions and houses, or like McCain, seven or eight mansions, and where people can have much more than what is necessary for them or their families to exist, even as other people go hungry and starve. And if that's the kind of society that you want, then, of course, then you fight for an Obama, you fight for a U.S. And but even while you're doing that, why don't you stop pretending around the nobility of your ideas? Stop pretending this religious nonsense, you know, about how you believe everybody should, you know, have all they need, and because, you know, being like, you know, whatever religious entity that you proclaim as your own. If you think that we should have a world based on greed, then line up on that other side so we can see you and know where you are. And of course, what we will do is we will know that some of you are there because you are stupid, because you have been duped, because you are dummies, because you don't know what your own interests are, and because you like somebody with a quick smile and a charming wit, etc. And we will make allowances for that, and we will try to win you to the right side so that you can come over and join the rest of us who are truly engaged in trying to build a new world, a new place for humanity, so that we don't have to engage in the kind of craziness that we are currently confronted with. But, you know, at least own up to, you know, the callousness and the baseness of your aspirations and stop trying to hide them behind, you know, these noble notions and ideas. We believe it's possible for there to be a different and better kind of world, and that's what we're going to fight for. And we won't be satisfied with this same relationship and the same world just because you give it a black face. I think we have to say that. Africa has to be free, and African people around the world have to be free. And a Barack Obama stands in the way of that, then he has to be opposed and fought with every bit of energy that we have in our possession. Uhura.
Uhura. Uhura. I want to take one last question, and this is, we got about 7 minutes left. This is from Kobina, who says, in this Obama hype, we see revolutionary organizations and petty boo organizations raise Obama up as a part of our continued struggle. How do we sum up this eclectic attempt to place Obama in the same light as Garvey and Malcolm X?
Oh man, I mean, it should be funny, but of course it's not. And I think part of what, you know, I just mentioned earlier is just the low level of political development that would allow people to be susceptible to that, not that allow opportunists and people who want to trick people into putting that forward, but there are a number of people who are susceptible to that kind of nonsense. But I think that one thing we've learned, we are materialists. And we know that at different times, what's in people's brain, what's in their head, their subjective understanding is not connected with the objective reality, what's in the world. And that for a while, people can even delude themselves into believing certain kinds of things. But sooner or later, objective reality catches up with us. And that objective reality is one where we have, you know, police killings of our people in the streets every day, where we have 1 out of 8 young Africans locked up in a prison, where we have billions of dollars of African people lost through foreclosures with the connivance of Obama forces, where poverty and infant mortality and school failure, you know, all of these things continue to stalk us in our communities on a daily basis, like lynch mobs. And that as the crisis deepens, we will see greater, we will see an even increased level of contradictions confronting us as a people. And our job as revolutionaries is to keep the covers off, is to do everything that we can to explain this phenomenon to people and draw them into revolutionary politic and revolutionary action. And because it is an instance where we are struggling with subjective things, that is the idealism, the ideas that people have in their heads that's not consistent with what's in the world. And we have to bring them an idea that helps to explain the real world as it is. And people, too, will not be fooled for long, for extraordinarily long periods of time. The Obama phenomenon, we will see, is not going to be as long-lived as the imperialists hope for. Yeah.
Uhura. Well, we're coming to the end of our time here, but
that's imperialism.
It's gonna come quicker. But we're coming to the end of the show for today. But it's okay, because unlike imperialism, we will be back.
Right on. What you can say, like, about the Obama cabinet, it is bad.
It's bad. Uhuru. So, that's okay. So this is the end of Africa Live, but next up we have Uhuru on the Move, hosted by MPDUM President Ivory Sabukwe Sudaye and Kobina Bantu Shango. So stay tuned here on UhuruRadio.com.
See, what I'm saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here, we're talking about the African working class. But what we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands. Africa Live. Africa Live. We can just raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people, we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumahs. And today, we have Omali Eshetela.
Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live. Wanna